Namaste Jai Hind, you're watching or listening to another edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. Since we are in the midst of elections, most of the conversations on the podcast are about elections and with politicians. But today we talk about foreign media and its interpretation of elections in India. So let's talk to Mr. Shashi Shekhar, former CEO of Prasar Bharati, the national broadcaster. He has written an article and also posted tweets on X regarding foreign interference in Indian elections. Welcome to the podcast, Mr. Shashi Shekhar. Glad to have you again here today. But we are in the thick of elections, so everything today discussion will be on elections and the fantastic research that you have done. I saw it on Twitter and on X. So those of us who are not on X or, you know, our listeners and viewers, we're going to decipher as to what all has happened and what is the research that you have done. Basically, 969 million Indians eligible to vote in India in this current elections. And you've written in an article also that, you know, think tanks and the media, foreign media, they have been working like on an overdrive to discredit the elections even before they had begun. We are now at the time of recording, we are doing the first phase is over and the second phase is about to happen in a couple of days. So we'll go into it one by one, but tell me what prompted you to do this research.
Sure. So in fact, very happy to be here and at such a momentous time, perhaps very consequential for India. The background and history to this research actually predates the elections. It goes back several years when I was the CEO of Prasar Bharati, when we saw a consistent pattern with the manner in which global media was reporting on India. Very specifically, I recall instances such as the anti-CAA riots, just about when President Trump was to visit India. Then, of course, the coverage during COVID-19. In fact, this entire research has been published as a serious research paper in the quarterly journal of the Indian Institute of Mass Communications back in December 2021, where we had analyzed a much larger body of articles, almost 5,000 plus articles, to look at the manner in which global media outlets have been reporting on India.
This is before the earlier election, before 2024 election.
Before 2024 election.
Okay.
So that is the background or backdrop within which, this particular set of links that I had shared and articles that I had pointed out, that the same pattern is repeating itself again in 2024, where the global media is taking a very activist role in trying to raise all sorts of questions to delegitimize the whole election process, be it with the electronic voting machines, be it with all these discredited or deeply flawed democracy rankings.
So the reporting on India is not an organic one that you're saying. You're saying a trend which doesn't seem to be non-motivated.
Absolutely. It's a trend and pattern that has been going on for quite some time. In fact, it's kind of stunning because after I brought out this list of headlines in the context of 2024, I went back and looked at what happened in 2019. It's an almost similar pattern of headlines. So it tells you that there's a certain biased lens with which global media has tended to look at India. And fortunately, that lens is informed by certain, individuals or certain organizations in India who have, sort of contributed to that view. And that view prevails. And I think that is the dominant view, unfortunately, in which India is being viewed.
So those of you who are on Twitter, now known as X, please do follow Mr. Shashi Shekhar. He's given an entire listing. Also, you can go into his article, which is in the Indian Express. But we've got a monitor out here where we've got all the headlines out. So those of you who are on YouTube will be able to see this. But those of you who are listening in on audio platforms, for their sake, I'm going to be reading out the headlines and we'll discuss this with Shashi ji, who's going to tell us, because it's his research, which very cleverly, I saw that Sam Petroda had just picked it up, copy-pasted, and not given you credit for that research.
It's appalling. I mean, someone of Mr. Petroda's stature to be, being so lazy, at least that he could have, altered some of the...
No, he did.
Nothing, he just copy-pasted.
I saw that even the quotation marks had been picked up. Okay, so let's go into this. And this these headlines are for the 2024 elections, even before the elections had begun. So Bloomberg begins by saying Modi is making India's polls all about himself, why India South rejects Modi and why it matters. Now, we don't even know at this stage whether the South has rejected Modi or not, because elections haven't begun.
Right.
Polling hasn't begun, but Bloomberg has decided that the South has rejected Modi. Modi's election campaign may have already peaked. So the campaign has not even started in right earnest when this article has begun. Because the real campaign begins when the first phase, just a week before the first phase of elections, but these have already come. And then we go on to Bloomberg continues, billionaire Raj is pushing India towards autocracy. India's voting machines are raising too many questions. I don't know how our voting machines raising questions. Like, physically impossible, but anyway. Modi's sledgehammer politics are battering Indian democracy. Billionaire press barons are squeezing media freedom in India. To explain this billionaire fascination. Firstly, I think Western media fascinated that India can produce billionaires. And then how dare billionaires own media? Of course, we forget Rupert Murdoch. We forget all the billionaires who own
Murdoch. Michael Bloomberg. The guy who owns Bloomberg is a billionaire. So, I mean, it is paradoxical. I mean, it is so laughable that Bloomberg should be raising these questions about so-called billionaires when Bloomberg is, in fact, owned by a billionaire himself.
A politician too. But here, our billionaires are not politicians.
Right.
Our billionaire owns own media, which all across Western democracies, you see that. Right. Then we go on to the Times of India, which picks up the Chatham House article. So Times of India gives it, democratic backsliding in India could prompt West to review its cooperation with India. And the Chatham House headline was, Modi's India has become less liberal, but better governed. Explain the oxymoron to me, please.
So in their worldview or in their thinking, the idea is that somehow Modi is authoritarian and hence India is better governed. Not because, processes have improved or, certain reforms have taken place, but because he's got this danda and, everyone is now
behaving. What is the choice before an electorate? Be badly governed and have more democracy, or have an autocrat and be better governed? Is that what Chatham House is trying to say, which gets picked up by everybody?
In fact, this is the false strawman that pretty much most of the global media outlets are trying to portray.
This trope.
This choice, this false choice, that somehow it is a choice between an autocratic regime and then, of course, some vague notion of a democracy, which is actually chaotic and anarchic in their mind.
Okay. Right. Then we go on to the next one, Financial Times. Is India's BJP the world's most ruthlessly efficient political party? Ruthlessly efficient, right? How India's democracy developed East Asian characteristics, like who? Pol Pot.
Yeah, again, it goes back to the same thing, that benevolent dictator.
Benevolent dictatorship. So, we are not looking at non-Asian characteristics of autocracy. But Asia should not have autocracy. Okay. The mother of democracy, in quote, is not in good shape. Like, this is fat-shaming us, or what are they doing, right?
Well, I think the context here was basically that, Arvind Kejriwal was arrested, and that somehow, a huge setback to democracy and reflects on the health of democracy. That was the editorial of Financial Times, right? And if you look at what is happening in the U.S., you got Donald Trump on trial. You have, in other countries, you have people like Sarkozy who gone to jail. You had all kinds of politicians serving and, retired, who had to face the rule of law. And here you have the Financial Times making the argument that somehow in India, the rule of law can wait. Let's first get the elections done.
Right. Next, we have foreign policy. Modi's Make in India didn't make jobs. The cult of Modi, how India's Prime Minister dismantled the world's largest democratic experiment. So we are 70 plus years into a functioning democracy with one aberration all through. All our governments have changed through the ballot, not the bullet. But we are still a democratic experiment. Whereas Pakistan, Bangladesh, any other or talk about a million other countries that I can think of, or in historically, they are not experiments, but India continues to be a democratic experiment. Modi slide towards autocracy. This is the favorite thing.
The two words that repeat the most with the highest frequency are, you know, autocracy and authoritarian. You see that all the time. Then you have these two nice phrases, democratic backsliding and shrinking of, you know,
democratic space. Right. We're going to get to the media part also. That will also come. We've already done the billionaire one. Jacobin says Narendra Modi is preparing new attacks on democratic rights. So they seem to have an in with the PMO or something like that, where they know that what is in Modi's mind. Not that any Indian knows what is in Modi's mind, but the Jacobin obviously has some sources. Narendra Modi is developing a new template for authoritarian control of the internet.
This is like somewhere completely out of whack. What are they even talking? Right?
Authoritarian control of the internet. Global internet. Okay, wonderful. Even Xi Jinping can't do that, right? Who can stop Modi and his authoritarian vision? Is this phishing for anybody to apply for some kind of funding or something? Who can stop him?
Well, in fact, this particular article and many of a similar line are actually Indians writing in these global publications.
Or people of Indian origin. Right. Next. After that, we have Lamond. India, democracy in name only. Right. India's elections this year stand out for their undemocratic nature.
This is an entire resume and career that has been built on demonizing Mr. Modi and Indian
Lamont.
Mr. Christophe Jaffrelot.
Okay. But also, elections haven't even begun, but they've already discredited. The Times says the modification of India is almost complete, punning on the word Modi. And it says, with democracy under threat in Narendra Modi's India, how free and fair will this year's election be? At least they're questioning. The others had already said that it's rubbish.
It's all done.
Right? Says that maybe. I think it's also possible that Time is hoping for an interview like Newsweek got it. So let's keep that one door open. Right? Next. The New York Times. Oh, lovely. Modi's temple of lies.
In fact, this is so disgusting. It is as disgusting as that cartoon of, you know, one of the Aam Aadmi's trying to join the elite space club, knocking on the door with a cow, right? Mm. And this particular op-ed, it is just incredible that the New York Times published this.
Could you imagine them ever writing Obama's Church of Lies? Would that happen? Would they write something like that? Or would they talk about a mosque in a similar manner, but a temple is open for...
Absolutely.
Right?
And the pun is intended, because it is very clear the reference is to the Ram temple.
To the Ram temple. Modi's power keeps growing and India looks sure to give him more. So they've already declared the results. I don't know whether we need to go through an electoral process. The New York Times already says that. Modi's India is where global democracy
it's
dies.
It's like, you know, we're not done with India. We're going to take care of democracy everywhere.
So we are the custodians of global democracy. So when we go in for polls, we have to wonder what happens to global democracy. Of course, China's not in consideration. Would they write this about Singapore, I wonder? Right? Would they write it about Indonesia? Would they write it about Malaysia? Would they write it about anybody else? Australia?
The gentleman who wrote this lives in Hong Kong.
So you're right.
There you go.
Wonderful. Then we have The Guardian. Lovely. The Guardian view on Indian elections, fixing a win by outlawing dissent damages democracy. So, of course, they are the custodians of democracy, right? Because they ruled us for how many years? Very democratically?
That was... 200.
Okay, that was such a democratic rule. As India goes to polls, can democracy deliver a better life for its people? The Guardian wants to know whether India would rather have an autocracy.
In fact, if you look at the manner in which the Guardian has been reporting on India, right? They've gone and picked these obscure villages in Uttarakhand and trying to portray an entire narrative around how Muslims are being victimized. And in fact, that dominates the entire story here in these reports.
Okay. Next, we have The Guardian itself, which says the US should not normalize Modi's autocratic and illiberal India at G20. They don't talk about their own prime minister, Rishi Sunak, coming. What bothers them is that, you have President Biden coming. So President Biden should not normalize. Rishi Sunak coming is okay. Nice. That G20 was under India's chair. That happened. Was that Modi's doing? Was that through an illiberal Modi or illiberal G20 that India becomes the chair? Not something that we chose, right? It happened.
Absolutely. I mean, it's by rotation, and you had it even came, autocracies hosting the G20. It's not only democracies hosted.
So then the observer view on the growing threat to democracy in India. Okay. That goes on. The Times. 2/3 of Indians back autocracy as Modi eyes the third term. So this is based on some survey, I'm guessing, because...
Yeah, this is the
Pew or what?
Not Pew.
Must be a survey because...
Yeah, it is a survey. It's a survey.
Indians haven't had an election. So how they have come to the conclusion that 2/3 of India...
It's one of the surveys which, you know, tries to play up this whole thing that, you know, Indians are fascinated with autocracy.
So while Indian channels for the past couple of days have been going on an overdrive to say that Modi may not come back after the first phase of elections, but the Times in London has already found that 2/3. So why elections are being held is really no need, actually. As India rises, can the West steer Modi away from autocracy? The white man's burden that the West has to work on India. Bhai, hum log nahi govern kar sakte apne aap ko. Aap aa jaiye, hume bataiye ki hum kis taraf mude. Right?
Yeah. And this is a theme that you see over and over with certain activists in India who may hate the US for everything else. But when it comes to India, they want to appeal to the West that, you know, yeah, please, why aren't you holding India accountable?
So it's not just Manishankar Iyer going to Islamabad or Karachi or wherever he went, Lahore, asking them to do something. It's Indian origin or Indian journalists in writing in these liberal, Western liberal media, asking them that can the West do something about it?
In fact, I recall there was a delegation that met Bill Clinton back then when the Pokhran 2 tests were done. Same thing. Why aren't you doing anything to, you know, hold India accountable?
Hmm. Okay. And then after that, we come to, there's one video which we haven't put out, which is, will the outcome of India's election increase intolerance? That was DW.
Yeah.
So they've already decided what the result is going to be, which is that the BJP is coming. And if the BJP comes, there is increase of intolerance. They've already decided what the agenda of Modi 3.0 is, if it happens. But they don't consider the if factor. So how did all this happen? When did you do this research? How long did it take for you to come up with all these? There's also Narendra Modi's regime suppresses freedoms, which is some Catholic News, LaCroix. What happened to the rule of law in India, Atlantic magazine? The tragedy of India's authoritarian descent, the Bullet Socialist Project. It just goes on. India is the future of the authoritarian internet, which is the Daily Dot in Austin, Texas. Wonderful. So Austin, Texas is worried that authoritarian internet is going to be something. Australian Institute of International Affairs says increasing authoritarianism. Right? It just goes on.
And in many of these instances, the key protagonists are people of Indian origin, either working there or activists who are, you know, seeking patronage from there. And that's a pattern that you see, you know, across the board.
Global Policy Journal UK says freedom of press is dealt deadly blows by Modi's proto-fascist regime in India. And then there's this continuous thing about personality cult,
right?
You know, lament for India's descent into authoritarianism. Modi's ethnic nationalism threatens to deepen divisions in subcontinent. Nikkei Asia. Why would the Japanese media go after Modi? And this is when, you know, Modi had this fantastic outreach towards Japan.
In fact, one of the best relationships is with Japan. I think we need to dig deeper, and I think this is where some of the facts that have come out in recent months about Chinese patronage or Chinese funding through Chinese proxies to certain media outlets has resulted in certain kinds of coverages. And this is not just in the context of India. I think there is well-documented information out there on how Chinese influence operations have worked in the US, in Canada, Australia, in terms of foreign interference, interfering with their elections. So we got to dig deeper that what is Nikkei Asia's agenda here? Who's really behind it?
Hmm. Why would they? And then there are several others which you have listed, which is Australian media, which goes on to say, that again, autocracy and the tragedy that, India is not sitting up to fight against this Hinduism. Modi's slide towards autocracy, how Modi is using Hinduism to turn India into an autocracy. So using Hinduism. This is the
but that's
policy.
A very concerning trend that the careless manner in which references to Hinduism or Hindutva are being made in the context of autocracy or authoritarianism or intolerance, they don't dare to do that in the context of any other religion.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's very, very troubling.
Wait, and let's talk about countries who, who we think are very upholders of freedom or at least friendship with India. We have Haaretz, it's Israel, which says India under Modi is becoming a brutal authoritarian state. Israeli media saying that India is becoming a brutal authoritarian state, right? I mean, the irony died a couple of breaths while this headline, I was reading this headline. So why would Israel do this?
Well, I think the Haaretz, my guess is, has a certain ideological line that they take on issues. So maybe that's probably why they view even Netanyahu in a similar light, is my suspicion. So that is an outlier, clearly, in that entire trend. Why would an Israeli publication, write something of that nature? But if you look at the broad spectrum, there are four patterns that you clearly see. One is, you have foreign correspondents in India who tend to rely excessively on certain sources. For example, the only people they talk to are Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, Ramchandra Guha, those are the sources of opinion based on which their reports are colored.
The Khan Market consensus.
Right. So that is one set. Then the second set is people of Indian origin who are writing op-eds and opinion columns in or reporting for these guys in the foreign press. So that's the second category. The third category are these NGO activists who operate in these journals and certain think tanks, and they've been putting out certain views. The fourth is a very peculiar animal, which is the one that you read out, Deutsche Welle. Similarly, there was an incident with ABC Australia where their bureau chief was asked to go back, or basically her visa. was not renewed. Now, when a public broadcaster is reporting on India from India, we don't make a distinction between the public broadcaster and the state that they come from, because they are an extension of that state. So to me, it is the state of Germany commenting on India, or the state of Australia commenting on India. And just look at what is happening between the Australian state and Elon Musk over that video, where today they are demanding that not only is that video to be taken down in Australia, but globally that video should not be accessible at all. And you look at the Australian Prime Minister's comments that this is not about freedom of speech. This is about spreading falsities that can foment violence. Come on, that's the exact same thing your correspondent is doing here in India. Right. You are, fomenting falsities which can lead to violence. So where is the question of freedom of speech? They don't see the irony.
What about BBC? That's a broadcaster too, a state broadcaster.
Absolutely.
Public
in fact,
broadcaster.
The BBC went through this whole process where they said we'll separate out the global arm and the public broadcasting in the UK. So they created this separate arm. But even that separate arm was still BBC. And it ran foul of Indian law, and hence now they've created this, new entity, which is supposed to be an Indian entity, which will supply news to BBC.
Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera, again, if you look at, in fact, their conduct in 2019 was horrible. And you will see the list of headlines from Al Jazeera, downright communal. In fact, it is ironic that, they ask questions like, what happens to Indian secularism when you look at their entire reportage. It is completely through the lens prism of religion.
But they want secularism in India, but not in...
That's the irony.
Right.
Right.
When we see this, and then you had Sam Pitroda, who's advisor to Rahul Gandhi, he retweets or he copy pastes your research and puts it out there. The idea is that what you had done was that to show the perfidy in this. You see, you are saying that there's an insidious trend
right.
in reportage of from India or on India. But when he puts it out there, he tries to say that India has become the hellhole, which entire world can see it has become. So those who are following his Twitter handle will probably think that, right?
Yeah. In fact, it's kind of symptomatic of the manner in which the Congress and their entire ideological ecosystem has been conducting itself, where they try to seek validation from the global media. And you see this with even Mr. Rahul Gandhi when he goes and does these interactions in foreign universities. Again, it's the same mindset that you are looking for validation, and that's what Mr. Pitroda's tweet kind of reflects. That this is what we've always been saying, and here the global media is also saying the same thing.
So tell me, how is it that so many media outlets cannot get the complexity of India and Indian elections? Why is it? Or is this just the first time that this is happening? Because I've worked with foreign media outlets. Clearly, there is a bias. That is true. I'll tell you one incident. I remember when Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated, I was working as a researcher for, at that time, for a foreign American network. And when they came out here, they were like, okay, how many million people do you think are going to come to Delhi for the funeral? So I said, no, not million. So how many 100,000? How many will come in? Will there be riots? And which part of India will there be riots? How many people will die in the riots? So you had the entire global media descend in Delhi because they thought the similar kind of thing that what happened with Indira Gandhi's assassination will happen again with Rajiv Gandhi's assassination, that India would go down that path. It didn't happen. All they could get was that anti-riot vehicles. At that time, we didn't have, the rapid right. action and all that. But there was somewhat kind of armored vehicles which moved in on Teen Murthy. Those couple of shots of those vehicles moving in was what was broadcast across the world. That, India is going to go into anarchy, which happened when Mrs. Gandhi died. The similar kind of riots will happen. It didn't happen. And those guys just went back so disappointed that they didn't have a story at that time. And I was like, okay, meri 3 din ki dihaadi banni thi, ek din mein khatam ho gayi, right? Because they all left, that nothing happened. Nothing happened at the funeral, nothing happened post that. So why is it that they cannot get Modi right? Or why is it that they want that Modi is not going down the anarchist path, or he's not collapsing like the way they want him to?
Right. So I think there are several factors at work. Let me first talk about the Modi angle, and then I'll talk about the bigger
okay.
angle. Right. I think Modi is an enigma to them. Right. They cannot reduce him to their stereotypes, and that is the problem. Right. Because he talks climate action, he talks Swachhata, he talks about inclusion. Right. You look at Man Ki Baat, all his themes are can pass off as progressive themes. Right. So here you have someone they would like ideally to caricature like Trump, but then he's anti-Trump in every respect, right? And that is their problem. They're just not able to fit him within that stereotypical image, and hence they do they kind of lose it in terms of analyzing him and not really getting him. But coming to the bigger question, why does the global media report on India in the way it does? I think that it's a combination of factors. In fact, the research that I mentioned, which was published in the IMC journal, it talks about this Norwegian professor who passed away recently, called Johan Galtung, who has studied conflict media. And his theory, I believe it was published in the 1960s, is that media tends to look for discord, division, because that is what drives media. And hence, they're always seeking conflict and controversies in every which is why those guys who, the poor fellows who got disappointed when, you know, the Rajiv Gandhi assassination took place, that they didn't see the kind of conflict that, because he calls it conflict journalism, and that's what drives media, that negativity. The other aspect, which I think is very important for us to recognize, is India is now one of the biggest open internet digital markets for English news. And all of these publications have pretty much plateaued in their markets. They don't have much room to grow there. So anytime they pick any controversy in India, it is clickbait journalism for them. It drives their digital traffic and ultimately it reflects on their digital revenues. And hence this tendency to pick up controversial subjects from India, because they know that an entire army on social media is going to pounce on it and their links are going to get more and more visibility. So that's the second phenomenon that I see. The third is, in the research paper, we looked at this, citing a couple of sources, which is the how remunerative and how lucrative it is for people of Indian origin to write in these foreign publications, because they get paid by several times, factor of several times higher than they would have probably gotten paid in India. And hence, there is an incentive for them to feed the foreign media the kind of copy that they want, because it drives traffic for them and it pays off well for these guys. So you have that virtuous cycle, or rather a perverse cycle, playing itself out. I think the fourth reason which why these guys report in this manner is because they don't understand India's diversity. They largely go by the consensus view that emerges in Delhi, like Khan Market or Lutyens Delhi or whatever you want to call it. Very few of them understand Indian languages. Most of them rely on a few people here, like I pointed out, individuals who are known to have a certain ideological bias, but who tend to be their trusted sources for a perspective on India. These guys barely go out and report in the rest of India. And I think that is a problem.
Because budgets are shrinking, right? Reporting budgets are shrinking, not in India, but in the Western world.
Absolutely.
It's shrinking. So one air ticket for, round trip ticket to Chennai will set them back by, say, 50,000 rupees to 60,000 rupees, just the air ticket, then the hotel and moving around. So it is expensive to report. They'd rather go by the reportage which is done by somebody else and then sit in Delhi and report. So that trend was there even in 2019.
Right.
Reporting budgets had shrunk. So it's secondhand reporting. Now, there's one headline out here. Has Modi pushed Indian democracy past its breaking point? This is by the New Yorker magazine. Now, this is something which is finding echo even in Indian reporters who are writing that. I saw this happening in 2019 also, where there was this hashtag which said just one more year or something like that, 2018. It started off in 2018, bas ek saal, ek aur saal, just one more year, where there was this whole bunch of Indian writers who wrote that because the BJP had lost a couple of state elections. So it was a done deal. Everybody thought that it's just one more year. And in 2019, when the elections are held,
democracy will be back.
Democracy will be back. So it was, breaking point had not yet arrived that Modi would be a one-term prime minister. 2019 happens and he comes back the second time. But those articles continue to come even in the, by the Indian writers who say that it's come to breaking point. This is not the India we knew. This is not badal gaya hai pura. This is not the India for which my father fought as a freedom fighter. That kind of, have you heard those kind of conversations?
In fact, I've seen this every 12 to 18 months since 2014. First, it was about the attacks on the churches. Democracy as we knew it has ended. Then it was award wapsi. Then it was, CAA riots. Then it is, COVID mishandling and COVID deaths. So pretty much every 18, 24 months, you have this trend of picking on some set of events and trying to craft a narrative that India, civilization as we knew it, has already ended. Right? And this has been repeating itself because this section that has lost out since the emergence of Modi, because they had a certain monopoly, a certain sway on the narrative and power in Delhi, and now they've lost it. They are just desperate to get it back, and hence they're all the time looking for something to latch on to.
explain this thing about, I mean, I have witnessed it, but explain to the viewers about a certain section which had a sway on the narrative. Did you notice that? Because you came to Delhi when Modi came to Delhi. You were an outsider too. You're not a career bureaucrat who came in. Right. You came in from the private sector, came in when Modi came in a little later. So tell me about your view about what you saw in India before Modi came in on the narrative monopoly.
Yeah. So this is something that has been there much prior to Modi, right? We even saw it during the Vajpayee years as well. That a certain section of left-leaning ideologues who have dominated, the op-ed columns, who have dominated the NGOs, perhaps some of them are very eminent lawyers, so they dominated the court proceedings, the PILs. They have always tended to have a sort of a monopoly or a sway on, what is right or what is moral or, what is the right way to do things. And if something didn't fit that their worldview, their activist worldview, then it was the end of everything, right? And here you had Mr. Modi, who was challenging that dominance. And many of them enjoyed access to power. Many of them were rewarded with, Padma Awards and so on. They would all go with the Prime Minister on these foreign travels. So they were kind of pretty much holding the sway in terms of what is the mood of the nation, so to speak, right? They were the arbiters or they were the high priests of, what is right and what is wrong. And then Mr. Modi comes and he breaks that entire stranglehold. And these people are suddenly, they're staring at a vacuum where they no longer have access. They're completely shut out of the system. And then piece by piece, the Prime Minister has pretty much dismantled that entire edifice, right? You no longer have Padma Awards going to these journalists. You no longer have foreign trips.
No Rajya Sabha seats,
right? So the only things left for them are, these access to the foreign media outlets and that's where they're...
And no government housing.
No government housing.
That was another thing which was there where journalists got government housing. Yeah. That also went away with the Modi government. But actually, it went away a little before that in the sense that rules came in, but they continued holding on to the housing in some of them. But, you mentioned Vajpayee, Prime Minister Vajpayee. That was another BJP government which was there. The thing with the Vajpayee era is that he didn't really take on those journalists. Right. He co-opted them. His was a different style of a PMO. He co-opted them instead of going against them and instead of shutting the doors on them, he co-opted them. He gave them programs on Doordarshan. There were channels which opened Doordarshan International, is it, or something like that. And there were a couple of channels they were given access to Racecourse Road, which was called 7 Racecourse Road, was the Prime Minister's office. He would call them over for lunches and dinners. And there was this... So, he was, the right wing, of course, loved him because he was their prime minister. But the left media, which was the Congress media, was co-opted by Prime Minister Vajpayee. That didn't happen with Mr. Modi.
Absolutely. I think what Mr. Modi has done is that he has democratized the media landscape. I mean, just look at your podcast, right? How it is, now done so well in the English media, news media landscape, for example. Mm. Look at the number of upstart channels that have emerged over the last 10 years. In fact, when people accuse Mr. Modi of, having shrunk the whole media landscape or, shrunk freedom of speech, they're missing out the fact that he has actually leveled the playing field where several new news channels have emerged. When look at the rise of Republic and Arnab, or TV9, for example, right? They've all emerged to challenge the incumbents.
There are more than 400 TV channels, satellite channels.
300 news channels. News channels. 900 overall television channels. Extremely competitive landscape. And remember who enabled this competitive landscape. It is not the private platforms. It is the government-run DD Free Dish, which has actually made the media landscape competitive, where an upstart channel has equal access to the same reach in terms of 50 million plus households as an incumbent channel. And which is why a Republic or a TV9 or a Dangal is able to challenge the big guys, right? And that's a government-run platform. So it's not just Doordarshan on it. You also have, these several other news channels also competing for, the viewers' attention.
Yes. And open internet, anybody can open. Absolutely. So, you know, you may not have access to speaking with the Home Minister or the Defense Minister or the Prime Minister or the Home Secretary. You probably don't have access to them, but it's not necessary you need to have access. You can still do your journalism. You're seeing top journalists who are on YouTube now. They don't have a job.
And why is that possible? Because you have the lowest data rates in India.
Correct.
Where video watching has been made so accessible. Yeah. In fact, that's another democratic leveler. Hmm. So when you look at democratic space in India, you got to recognize, you know, these fundamental shifts that have happened and not just look at what a handful of news channels are showing between, you know, 8 p.m. and 10 p.m.
You know, when we were talking about your article, in that you even mentioned the rating agencies now, VDEM ratings, where India is ranked even below Mexico. So those who may not have read the article, can you tell us a little bit about these rankings and about how does India come below Mexico?
Very important, I think. So VDEM is this Swedish, agency, which ranks democracies across the world on, you know, various parameters. Now, the paradox of these democracy ratings is they're anything but transparent. They're actually very opaque because there's a lot of subjectivity. We don't know who are the individuals who are rating these countries and on what basis. Mm. And the irony is Mexico, for example, has had the highest number of murders of mayoral candidates over the last 6 months. And this is a data point that was shared by a very respected analyst, global analyst, Ian Bremmer. Now, Mexico ranks much higher than India in the democracy ratings. All right. And another data point, the RSF, which is Reporters Without Borders, they rate countries on freedom of speech index. And according to them, Mexico is much higher than India in terms of free speech. While the Reuters Institute of Journalism in Oxford University found that Mexico had the highest number of journalist murders, higher than war zones of Ukraine and Syria. So how in the world can Mexico be more free and more secure for media or politicians or democracy than India? It's a paradox. Now, here is the joke, right, that Hong Kong is rated higher than India in terms of freedom of speech.
Oh, wonderful.
And the irony is RSF sends its reporters to Hong Kong to report on the trial of the democracy activists. And the RSF reporters are detained at Hong Kong airport and deported back to France. So the joke is on Reporters Without Borders, yeah, that how flawed and how ridiculous their ratings are.
Tell me about the whole visa system for foreign journalists. If they report anti-India stories or anti-Modi stories, do they get deported? Because people just wonder with all this Australian broadcasting. Do they need accreditation? Disclaimer, I'm on the accreditation committee. Explain to our viewers about the whole system of when foreign journalists come to India, what do they need to do to report on elections out here? And subsequently, Indians going to, say, cover the US elections, what do they need to do since you've lived in America too?
Well, I think any country, right, a visa is a privilege, it's not a right, right? And when you are granted a visa, you are granted with certain norms in place. And if it's a journalistic visa, then there are certain norms within which you need to conduct your profession, right? So when you come to India and you report on the elections, but you report in a manner where your reportage can potentially affect the territorial integrity of India. Like, for example, what this Australian journalist did, the manner in which Sikh separatism was reported on, the manner in which this whole theory of, you know, India's involvement in certain incidents in Canada was hyped up. I think all those are, where you're crossing the line, where the territorial integrity of India is under threat. And I think that is where you cross the line. And perhaps rightly so, the government was did what it did with visas to that particular team. But I think there's a bigger issue as well. When foreign journalists want to come to India and they want to report on India, one is the stick approach. I would say another approach would also be to mandate that they need to understand India. And there perhaps should be an MEA-sponsored program of some sorts where they're forced to, you know, go to different parts of India, maybe learn a few languages, get a cultural orientation. So they understand India and all its diversity, all its complexity.
But there's one aspect which is journalist reporting. Then comes, somebody who comes in as an NGO activist, right? They come here, they travel wherever they want to and things like that. And then once they go back to their country, then they write op-ed articles. Those are some of the what we ran out right here, where, you know, their view about what is happening in South India or what is the slide of democracy and all those headlines which you see. So they don't need a journalist visa to come into India.
Right.
They don't need a pass to cover elections. Some of them even hire Indian journalists with the kind of bias that they have about India. Those get hired. So there are ways and means to bypass Indian media laws.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's far more insidious when it happens through this route, because many of them are sponsored by all kinds of foundations. It could be a Soros Foundation, or it could be, you know, any of these big multi-billion-dollar, left-leaning NGO organizations that are sponsoring their research, sponsoring their work. And it is agenda-driven, because India being India, one of the largest open markets, it has become a petri dish for all of their experiments, with be it climate change agenda or be it these so-called internet freedom agendas. So pretty much everyone wants to experiment with their pet theories in India. And India being an open, democracy, it's easier. And then you have enough fault lines here to exploit. In fact, I was just reading this morning, there's some academic in the UK who says that, if there's no caste census, how will we do our research? So they want to come looking for fault lines in India and look for all kinds of data that will feed those theories that will, further build up on these fault lines.
Right. There is one section on social media which say that, why do we pay so much attention to what foreign media writes about India? Why do Indians need validation from Western media about what India is or what Indian democracy is? So you tell me, what is your view about that?
No, I think it should matter. It does matter, because today the world is connected in much more deeper ways than it perhaps was, a couple of centuries back. There is an Indian diaspora in these countries. There are strong economic ties between India and several of these countries. And perception gets colored. And hence, it is important that people understand India in the right way. So that is a very India-centric way of looking at it.
Mm.
Also, there's a global way of looking at it. I think that today India is an example for the global South. We have made democracy work at the scale of a billion, which nobody else has, not even close to it. Right. So hence, the Indian democratic journey is very important. I'm sure it will inspire several other countries that, if India can make it work with all its complexity at this scale, we can also do it. Right. So to that extent, I would think, projecting the India story is very important to the rest of the world.
So why is the upward trajectory of India unsuitable, not just for think tanks in the liberal West, not just for the media in the liberal West, but even for some governments in the Western, the Anglo-Saxon world? You have almost on a daily basis now, you're seeing U.S. State Department comment on internal matters of India, whether it is Rahul Gandhi's legal battles or whether it is Kejriwal's incarceration, as they call it. So why does India's upward trajectory disturb them?
Because a strong India and a powerful India will be its own master. It will not answer to them. It will not look to them to seek validation. And it becomes a very powerful counterexample to China. Right. Today, the West is a counterexample to China, but tomorrow India becomes a counterexample to China, and India has its own independent path. I think that troubles several of them. And of course, China is obviously troubled that what is the message that goes to their own people, that if democracy can work at a scale of a billion in India, why can't it work in China?
Hmm. But sometimes it's difficult to understand the Americans. In a situation where something happens, say, in Taiwan, where China does that, when they're seeing a fight with the dragon, do they want India on their side or not want India on their side?
Well, I think obviously all of them want India on their side, but they would ideally want it on their terms, right? I think that is where the conflict is. It's not so much about India being on their side, but it's on whose terms? Whether it's on India's own terms or on their terms.
But even when India was not as strong as it is today, even then India did not toe the line of the Americans. Off the cuff, I can just remember when the planes during the Desert Storm, when America wanted to refuel their planes, and Mr. Vajpayee, who was really not in a position to say no to America, got the parliament to say no.
Right.
And told the Americans that, I'm sorry, but the Indian parliament says no and I cannot have you fuel your planes out here. A weaker India in that time, who still stood up to America. So why would they do, why would America think that a strong India will not stand up to them?
I think it's a reflection of how poorly they understand India. And I think this is where perhaps a lot more work needs to be done. In terms of India studies, and I'm sure the kind of platforms that we've created in the last few years, like Raisina Dialogue and so on, and perhaps more of them are required so that the world understands geopolitically India better. And I think Dr. Jayashankar that way has been proven to be a very great outspoken spokesperson.
About the Indian way of doing things.
And I think more of that needs to happen. And also soft power, right? And you know, putting the Indian perspective in the Indian way on Western media platforms, I think is important. And I'm sure, you know, we are making a beginning there as well very soon on that.
Yes.
So I think all these will matter going forward.
You know, there's the New York Times has one which says, "Lights, Camera, Modi. It's a one-man show on Indian television." You've been CEO of Prasar Bharati. What is the obsession with Modi that private television channels as well as Indian television channels, for the generation of Indians born after Indira Gandhi, nobody's seen this kind of cult worship that you're seeing on state broadcasters as well as private broadcasters. What is it about Modi that makes...
Well, I wouldn't call it cult worship. I think he forces a debate, right? He forces you to take a sharp position. I think that is what really is driving the conversations around him. And no other political leader in recent years in India has been able to do that. And I think that is perhaps what is the phenomenon that we are seeing across television studios or op-ed columns, that he becomes a focal point of that debate. And he's able to force that debate because he has really challenged conventional ways of thinking. He's challenged stereotypes. He's dismantled in a lot of structures, incumbent structures that have been dominating the city for a long time. And all of that has forced debate.
But it, why private television channels? Because numbers, ratings, what is it? Because, see, why would a private television channel do it? Because of viewers.
Absolutely.
Right? So, what is it about Modi that he's doing 3 to 4 speeches these days? Right? See the comparison. Like a Rahul Gandhi, if you were to compare, would do one rally a day or one road show a day. Considering that he's an underdog right now, you would think that he'd work harder. Mamata Banerjee does 1 in 2 days. Mayawati does 1 in a week. Akhilesh Yadav barely does anything. Modi does 4 in a day. He's taking on all of them. Modi does 4 in a day and all 4 of them run on national television. Regionals may not because of Hindi language. So some of them may not run live. But he runs on a majority of them. So why? What is the compulsion to run Modi live 4 times a day?
Because he's going to make news and you don't want to lose out on that. And exactly what you pointed out, that viewers want to see this. And the other interesting thing about the Modi rallies is that the amount of preparation that goes into it. So you will see something new in every speech, right? And that also forces you to not miss out, because he's going to say something completely different. He said, he talked about, for example, the whole Congress thing with redistribution in Rajasthan.
Redistribution.
And
wealth,
that dominated the news cycle. And then he goes, and then everyone thought,
For those of viewers and listeners who don't know, just to put it in context, this is Mr. Modi lashing out at the Congress over their manifesto. In their manifesto, they talk about, now you can tell me about that.
So the manner in which Mr. Rahul Gandhi has been talking about, you know, doing an X-ray on India and trying to redistribute, you know, the resources or the wealth of the country with, you know, minorities and various other communities and so on. So he brought that up and put it in a very pithy manner. that the lowest common denominator of the audience would understand. Obviously, that got a lot of people riled up. That, you know, dominated the whole news cycle. Everyone thought he's going to do the same thing in Aligarh. And in Aligarh, he talks about what he's done with the Muslim community. So he stumps you every single time. And I think that is
that was the other thing he said is that in Aligarh, he talked about that he had reached across to Prince Salman and increased the Hajj quota.
Yeah.
Right?
And then talked about triple talaq. True. And then, in fact, this is something that barely got reported. You have the first woman vice chancellor of Aligarh Muslim University appointed after 1920, a hugely progressive step, right? So he has this ability to spring surprises, and hence the news cycle follows him.
Right, but you were talking about the lowest common denominator. What happens is that the TV channels pick that up because he's using a language of the street. Right. Now, those who are from the elite sections of society, which is where the media used to be,
right?
The earlier media used to be from the convent educated and, you know, Rhodes scholars and those kind of people who had the domination. For them, there was a kind of a sophistication in telling the India story. There was a sophistication that the prime minister's speeches had. So, that you are not seeing with the Modi. So Modi gets down to, language which people understand, which is like, you know, tutu meme kind of a language. You know, it's that tutadarwari language where he talks in that, na, kya yaar, that kind of a language, which comes as a shocker. Now, when they are shocked and they report, that is the shock which you see in the foreign media then.
Absolutely. In fact, that shock wave is what is getting amplified and reflected out there. While in reality, what Mr. Modi is really doing is communicating to the common man, the last person at the strata of the society, in a language that they understand, with idioms and metaphors that they can relate to.
Yeah,
I think when he talks about Mangal Sutra, or he talks about how every the wealth of the mothers and sisters, the jewelry, their wealth will be. It's basically driving home the point that if you take this logic, this entirely divisive or aggressive logic of redistribution towards extremities, this is what will happen.
Yeah. So, you know, not many Indian reporters could understand that. So can you imagine the foreign media trying to figure out what does a Mangal Sutra metaphor mean?
Right.
So basically, for our viewers and listeners, what was happening was that when Congress said that there'll be, when Rahul Gandhi said that there will be a forensic audit of the wealth that is in the hands of private individuals, and then jitni abadi utna hak, so it will be redistributed based on the number of backwards minorities, backward castes, minorities including Muslims, it would be redistributed among the poor. When he talks about that and about the forensic audit, so what Modi was trying to do was, what he was trying to say for a woman. Now, a rural woman doesn't own property. Most rural women don't own property. They don't have fixed deposits, many of them. What is their, traditionally, what is their wealth? It is Tridhan, which is the gold or the Mangal Sutra, which she has. So when Modi was trying to say that this forensic audit, he didn't explain it in great detail, but that's what he was trying to say, which I think overshot most people when he was doing that. So the Indian media reported it differently, and of course the foreign media is going to go into paroxysms.
They've all picked it up, and now they're blowing it up. But I think the point remains that when you are talking of jitna abadi utna hak, it's a very, very regressive, highly divisive rhetoric, and its dangers had to be highlighted, and that's what he's done on the campaign trail.
I want to come back to, since all the headlines equated Indian democracy with Modi's ascendance and Modi cracking down on the media, and Modi cracking down on dissent. Do you think that Modi's role in 2002, when he was Chief Minister of India, Chief Minister of Gujarat, and the riots happened out there, his bitterness with the Indian media's reportage then carried on when he became prime minister, and then the media, which had a view, certain view, international and Indian media view about Modi, that continued. So what you're seeing is a continuation of that chapter.
In a way, yes. If you look at his relationship with media, it has always been a difficult one. Because media has tended to be, first of all, they never understood him. And they've tended to report in a very exaggerated manner. We saw that in Gujarat when he was chief minister. And then when he was denied the U.S. visa, that history carried on. And when he became the prime ministerial candidate, the entire narrative was focused on that. So that legacy continues. Now, he has also, if you look at how he has dealt with it, he has used technology to disintermediate the media at every step, right? Be it with social media, so he gets
even
his message,
before he became PM.
Even before he became PM, with his social media being the his way of directly communicating to the people, live streaming being, you know, the way to directly get his events and speeches out without having to rely on media coverage. And then using digital platforms for campaigning, now using artificial intelligence to break the language barrier. So at every stage, he has been using technology in a big way to disintermediate the media. And media is playing catch up, trying to understand him. Now, of course, with the global media, the next challenge would be to be able to break that barrier and get the global media outlets to better understand him. I know the current where we are at with this election and the kind of reportage that we've been talking about, clearly that gap is significant. There has to be a better way to, bridge that gap. One is, of course, Indian media having global presence. Second could be content from India finding its way to global platforms. And perhaps some kind of mechanism by which foreign media in India are put through an orientation program where they better understand India.
Why does the West use different matrix to report on India and, say, report on Pakistan, report on China, report on other East Asian countries? Why different matrix?
Well, I think India is being so large, right? And fact that anything that happens in India will have bearing elsewhere. They tend to have a different yardstick. Also, I've noticed, again, I may be wrong in this, so I don't have hard numbers to back it up. But I've noticed that many of the times when a foreign media outlet hires a person of Indian origin, they tend to be making a very conscious choice that they are mostly people from a religious minority group. And I think that clearly plays in the kind of slant their reporting takes. Now, it is not a very overt thing, but we did see when New York Times put out its advertisement to hire a correspondent for India, the manner in which they framed that job description, it was very clear it was anti-Modi. So that kind of tells you that when they are looking for talent from India, they're making some very conscious choices.
And this, though it isn't part of the scope of this discussion, but it's also there when students apply for PhD programs. This is what I've heard, that which slant your PhD is taking, your study is taking, that also matters in getting your student loan, your backing, at these left liberal campuses
and we are seeing how that is playing out right now and with what's happening in American university campuses.
Yes, in Columbia.
In Columbia, in Yale, Harvard, you know, everywhere else.
I was in fact reading so many Indian journalists, you know, who are regional journalists who said that we got through the tests and admission into Columbia, but our parents couldn't afford the school fees. And thank God that we didn't go, because this is what it has degenerated to. Imagine an Indian parent sitting in India paying what, $50,000 a year would be the tuition and boarding and lodging. Forget about the tickets to come to India. $50,000 a year, obviously loan, or if it's a middle class family, can barely afford that kind of money. You send your child to study in Yale and Harvard and Columbia, and they are, you know, sitting out there and raising Palestine slogans instead of attending classes. And classes now have become virtual instead of doing it. So the journalism students who said that Columbia School of Journalism, this is where we wanted to go, and look what's happened out there.
Absolutely. I think it is disgraceful what's happening in these university campuses, and the manner in which certain behavior has been normalized to the point of where it is threatening and it is intimidating for example, the Jewish students. I think it's very, very troubling. And today it is a Jew, tomorrow it could be somebody else.
What about the logo of Doordarshan? What do you have to say to that? That became a big point when, it's become saffron.
Yeah, it's a non-issue. I think Mr. Jawahar Sarkar, I think he was sleeping all these years and he suddenly seems to have woken up. In 2019, when we revamped DD India, the logo was already changed. He didn't pay attention.
It was already orange color or saffron color. And that saffron color was chosen by Indira Gandhi, it seems.
Well,
or she was Prime Minister and IB Minister at that time, information broadcasting. Yeah,
possibly, but again, aesthetic standpoint, even Al Jazeera has saffron in its montage and its color theme. So I think it's more to do with aesthetics more than anything else. I think Mr. Sarkar has clearly lost his bearings. He was not paying attention.
Okay. Modi 3.0, last question. Modi 3.0, what is it going to mean for Indian media and foreign media?
Well, I think it should mean, it is the time for Indian media to come of age. Why don't we have global media brands, right? We have, look at what we've done with IPL. Today, IPL is the global standard for cricket. For a kid playing in Australia or South Africa or anywhere else, West Indies, the aspiration is to come to India and play in IPL. Right. So we've created a global brand, a global platform, which has defined the rules for how cricket will be commercialized or played or monetized and so on. Why can't we take those lessons and bring them to the world of media as well? Right. I think it's about time that India had a global media brand, which lays down the norms of journalism, which lays down the norms of reportage, and the West emulates that.
Because there are many people who are saying that if Modi comes in the third term, a number of channels, India doesn't need so many channels. He will make sure that one or two billionaires buy up all the channels.
Well, I don't know much about that, but the Indian media landscape is very, very competitive. And to understand it, you don't sit in Delhi. You actually have to go to the states, look at the different languages, the diversity of languages and how fiercely competitive media is in every one of those languages. And we're just in the beginning. If you look at the Northeast and the East, it's an underdeveloped market. It is not as developed from a private media standpoint as perhaps the South is, or Tamil Nadu is, for example. Mm. Right. So there's a lot of scope still for private media development, because there are markets which are underserved or unserved completely in terms of Indian languages. So I think there's a lot of scope for growth there. I don't see any one billionaire
dominating the media. Right. Thank you so much, Mr. Shashi Shekhar, for coming for the second time on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been
very illuminating, and looking forward to more such research, which helps us so much to understand, where the foreign media is and how the foreign media is looking at India.
So I need to give credit to one of my colleagues, Amol Parth, who actually did the painstaking work of a lot of that research of those 5,000 articles on global media. And he's the author of that paper. So not just me.
All right. Thank you so much.
You.
Thanks for being here. Thank you for watching or listening to this edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. Do subscribe and hit the like button. Namaste. Jai Hind.